So today I'll be talking about human brain specializations related to language and theory of mind. Many scholars have argued that one of the keys to our success as a species is our capacity for cumulative culture, the ability to transmit knowledge and ideas across generations, and then to build on those in a cumulative manner. It's widely assumed that transmitting culture across generations depends upon both language and mental perspective taking, or theory of mind. That is, we can teach and learn from one another more effectively when we use language and when we adopt others' mental perspectives. These are abilities that humans excel at compared with other species, including our closest living primate relatives, chimpanzees and bonobos. It stands to reason that there must be human brain specializations that support both language and theory of mind. But what are those? While other primate species may have components of language, only humans combine thousands of arbitrary symbols according to a defined set of rules to create phrases with a nearly infinite variety of meanings. So what is the neural basis for this cognitive specialization? We know that human brains are about 3 times larger than chimpanzee brains, so perhaps this explains why humans are capable of language, whereas other primates are not. However, this hypothesis is challenged by the observation that high-functioning human microcephalics with chimpanzee-sized brains have linguistic abilities that exceed those of language-reared chimpanzees. Perhaps, then, we must look for qualitative, not just quantitative, differences between human and chimpanzee brains. By studying language disorders caused by brain damage, 19th century neurologists like Paul Broca and Carl Wernicke identified regions of the human cerebral cortex that are critically involved with language. Broca's area in the left inferior frontal cortex was implicated in speech production, whereas Wernicke's area in the left posterior superior temporal gyrus was implicated in speech comprehension. Homologs of these language areas have been identified in non-human primate brains based on similar location, sidor architecture, and non-linguistic functions. Human Wernicke's and Broca's areas have some interesting specializations that may help to explain human linguistic abilities. For example, humans possess leftward asymmetries in both areas that are not found in other primates. Human Broca's area is larger in the left than the right hemisphere, and the cortical mini columns within Wernicke's area are also larger on the left than the right side in humans. Human Wernicke's and Broca's areas are connected by a white matter fiber tract known as the arcuate fasciculus. Neuropsychological studies have concluded that the arcuate fasciculus is involved in a wide range of high-level linguistic functions, including word repetition, naming, complex syntax, speech fluency, and word and sentence comprehension. So another question we can ask is whether non-human primates have an arcuate fasciculus, and if so, how it compares with the human arcuate fasciculus. We can address this question with a type of neuroimaging known as diffusion-weighted imaging, coupled with a technique known as diffusion tensor tractography. Diffusion tensor tractography is based on the principle that water will preferentially diffuse parallel to, rather than perpendicular to, the direction in which axons are oriented. Thus, by following the principal direction of water diffusion across voxels, we can estimate the trajectory of fiber tracts. Reconstructions of the arcuate fasciculus using diffusion tractography show that it links Broca's area, shown in blue, with Wernicke's area, which is circled in red, just as expected. However, it also reaches a large region of the temporal cortex ventral to classic Wernicke's area, as can be seen in yellow. This contrasts with many standard textbook illustrations that show it projecting exclusively between Broca's area and Wernicke's area. But when we go back to the original postmortem dissections of Desjardins, it's clear that the arcuate fasciculus extends beyond Wernicke's area and into the ventral lateral temporal cortex. We use diffusion tensor tractography to compare the arcuate fasciculus between humans, chimpanzees, and a more distantly related primate, rhesus monkeys. While we could identify an arcuate fasciculus in all species, it was a much weaker and more limited pathway in the non-human primates. So in macaque monkeys, there was a weak arcuate fasciculus that connected Broca's area homologue with Wernicke's area homologue. In chimpanzees, there was also a weak arcuate fasciculus pathway connecting Broca's area homologue with Wernicke's area homologue. And some of the chimpanzees also had weak projections that reached into the middle temporal gyrus just below Wernicke's area. In humans, however, in addition to a direct connection between Broca's area and Wernicke's area, we find a massive projection into the region ventral to Wernicke's area, including the superior temporal sulcus, the middle temporal gyrus, and even the inferior temporal gyrus. And we think this may be an important neuroanatomical difference that helps to explain some of the linguistic abilities that humans have but other species lack. While diffusion tensor imaging can be vulnerable to both false positive and false negative results, other researchers have used the gold standard retrograde tracer technique to identify an arcuate fasciculus in macaque monkeys, which is shown here in red. And this reconstruction looks reassuringly like our own DTI reconstruction. The pronounced species difference that we observe in the arcuate fasciculus seems to be specific to the arcuate fasciculus. Such differences are not found in control pathways like the geniculostriate pathway or the corticospinal tract, or even other pathways implicated in language like the extreme capsule pathway. So what is the function of this ventral lateral temporal cortex that the human arcuate fasciculus uniquely reaches? The meta-analysis that you see here implicates the region in multiple high-level aspects of language, including phonology, semantics, and syntax. In fact, recent whole-brain connectome analyses have identified this particular region of the human brain as being the most divergent with chimpanzees in terms of the pattern of connectivity. And here's another paper showing that the most pronounced differences in human and chimpanzee cortical connectivity are concentrated in the lateral temporal cortex. So to summarize the research on language, first, the human arcuate fasciculus is implicated in several different linguistic functions, including word repetition, lexical semantics, and complex syntax. Second, in contrast to chimpanzees and rhesus macaques, the human arcuate fasciculus extends well beyond classic Wernicke's area and into lateral temporal cortex involved in lexical semantics and syntax. And third, lateral temporal cortex is a particular focus of divergent connectivity between humans and other primates. Well, what about theory of mind? What do we know about its neural basis and human specializations in that regard? Theory of mind is the ability to make inferences about the thoughts, beliefs, and intentions of others. Human fMRI studies have implicated the regions shown here in theory of mind. These include the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex, the posterior superior temporal sulcus and surrounding temporoparietal junction area, and thirdly, the posterior cingulate cortex and the precuneus. These regions are also core nodes of what is known as the brain's default mode network. The default mode network is a set of brain regions that, first of all, are most metabolically active at rest. Secondly, they show decreased activation with attention-demanding cognitive tasks. And thirdly, they're functionally connected, which means their activity is synchronized with each other over time. One interpretation of research on the default mode network is that the network reflects our tendency to think about the mental states of both ourselves and others when at rest. We wondered whether chimpanzees might have a default mode network and whether it looks and responds like the human default mode network. To determine if chimpanzees have a default mode network, the first question to ask is which brain regions are most metabolically active at rest in chimpanzees. To answer this question, we had chimpanzees drink a solution with glucose tagged with a radioactive molecule known as F18-FDG. The dose of radiation is modest, and the same procedure is used in humans to image brain glucose metabolism. After ingestion, the glucose accumulates in cells in proportion to their metabolic rate. After all the F18-FDG has entered the brain, animals can be anesthetized and scanned with PET imaging to image the distribution of radioactivity, which is correlated with regional brain glucose metabolism. Critically, with this method, we are imaging brain activity during the uptake period when the animal is awake and conscious, not during anesthesia. Here you can see F18-FDG PET scans from a human, a chimpanzee, and a rhesus monkey. Areas colored yellow and white are the most radioactive and therefore the most metabolically active. We collected resting state PET scans from a sample of 5 adult chimpanzees and 8 adult human subjects. This slide shows a medial view of the 5% most active voxels in the resting human and chimpanzee brain. Note that both species show activity in both the medial prefrontal cortex and the medial parietal cortex, two core components of the default mode network. On the lateral surface, we also see activity in the temporoparietal junction region in both species, circled in green. However, humans additionally exhibit a strong leftward asymmetry that is absent in chimpanzees. Specifically, humans have left-sided activity in and around Wernicke's and Broca's areas that is not seen in chimpanzees, and you see that circled in yellow. This suggests that humans may be using language to think with while in the resting state. The second question to ask is whether activation within these areas decreases when chimpanzees are engaged in attention-demanding cognitive tasks. Indeed, we found that activation within these regions was suppressed relative to the resting state baseline when we had chimpanzees perform a match-to-sample task during the F18-FDG uptake period. The third question to ask is, are these areas functionally connected? In other words, is their activity synchronized with one another over time? To answer this question, we would need to image chimpanzees with fMRI. Although this has been done under anesthesia, the size and strength of chimpanzees has thus far precluded imaging awake chimpanzees with fMRI. However, other research groups have succeeded in imaging awake monkeys with fMRI. This research has revealed the presence of a default mode network in macaque monkeys that looks similar to the human default mode network, including activity in the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex, the medial parietal cortex, and the temporoparietal junction bilaterally. However, there are also some notable differences. For example, in contrast to humans, the medial prefrontal cortex cluster is poorly connected to the posterior cingulate cortex in macaques and other non-human primates that have been investigated. So in this slide, you can see that the connectivity between the posterior cingulate cortex and the medial prefrontal cortex is strong in humans, but weaker in the other primate species. It remains to be seen whether this will also be true of chimpanzees. Autism is often linked with theory of mind difficulties. So it's interesting to note that autism is also associated with decreased medial prefrontal cortex to medial parietal cortex connectivity, and that scales to the degree of symptom severity in autism. This is consistent with the possibility that medial prefrontal cortex to posterior cingulate cortex connectivity may help to explain specialized human theory of mind skills. Finally, this figure shows that the default mode network is a region of particularly expanded cortex in the human brain as compared with chimpanzees. Only the frontal parietal network shows greater expansion. So in this figure, in panel B, you can see all of the different resting state networks with the default mode network in red. And then panel C shows you the degree to which that cortex needs to be expanded in chimps to match the human brain. And so in red here, you see that the default mode network is the network that is the second most expanded network in humans after the frontal parietal network. So to summarize the research on theory of mind, first of all, other primates have a default mode network that is similar to that described for humans. Second, stronger long-distance connectivity between the medial prefrontal cortex and the medial parietal cortex may be a specialization of the human default mode network that may help to explain advanced theory of mind abilities in humans. And third, human versus chimpanzee comparisons suggest that the cortical regions of the human default mode network have expanded more than cortical regions belonging to other networks, except for the frontal parietal network. In this talk, I've highlighted neurobiological differences between humans and other primates that might help to explain our specialized linguistic and theory of mind abilities. Clearly, this work has only scratched the surface, and much more research is needed to fully understand neurological differences between humans and other primates that may help to explain our ability to socially transmit our ideas. Thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to your questions.